Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for tuning in. This is Tamina Watson, your host of Tamina Talks Immigration. Welcome. This summer, I decided to record a series called Legal Heroes in the Trump Era. I wanted to speak with some of the lawyers who have stepped up beyond their day jobs to make a difference in immigration, civil rights, and much more. I wanted their insights from their work in the last 4 years so we can learn lessons to take into the future, especially as one of the most consequential elections in America lies ahead. The interview series became a book called Legal Heroes in the Trump Era, The Inspired, Expand Your Impact, Change the World. The book can be found on Amazon and other outlets. I hope you will pick it up. Enjoy these interviews. I hope you'll learn a lot. Thank you so much for listening.
Hey, podcast listeners. Be sure to tune into Tamina Talks Immigration, where immigration attorney Tamina Watson discusses the latest on immigration news and issues. She talks to those who have impacted U.S. immigration laws and policies, as well as notable immigrants who have made great contributions. Check out Tamina Talks Immigration to also hear your questions be answered. Subscribe now for the latest on everything and anything immigration.
The Legal Heroes series of interviews were conducted during the summer of 2020. This particular interview was recorded on June 5th. Please keep that in mind as you hear any topical references. Enjoy the show.
I have a wonderful guest today, one of my dearest, dearest friends. Her name is Margaret O'Donnell. Margaret, thank you so much for being here.
It's such a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me, Tamina.
Well, I've been wanting to have you on my show for a long time, so I'm so glad that this is finally happening. You know, I want to have people understand who you are, where you came from, and what you're doing. And, you know, you're an immigration lawyer who is renowned and has accomplished so much, but you are doing some tremendous work in the field to educate people. And so before we dive into all of that, I would love for people to know, where were you born, where did you grow up, and where do you live now?
All right. Well, I was born in Ashland, Kentucky, and raised in Southern Ohio, Western Pennsylvania, and Central Illinois. My dad worked for a steel company and was transferred during the time I was growing up. So I experienced the Appalachia and the Midwest before I went to school in Chicago. So that I consider myself mostly a Midwesterner. When I think of home, I think of Central Illinois. And I've been in Seattle since 1991. I came out here, my brother and sister were here, and my whole family has seemed to migrate west. We love it out here.
And I'm so glad you're here, because I would not have met you otherwise. And you have been such a wonderful mentor to me and friends. So I'm very grateful for that. So did you always know you wanted to be a lawyer? What was your path to becoming a lawyer?
No, not at all. In fact, I knew myself as a writer first. That was always my dream of myself and what I did. Well, I was my family's writer growing up. So anybody need anything written, whether it was a letter or an essay, they would come to me. And I loved being that. And so my ambition, as I saw myself, was kind of vague. I was going to write, observe and write. I think those are one of my best skills and definitely interest in storytelling. So I was a storyteller. We used to gather in my street, because it was the 1950s when I grew up in small town Appalachia. And what we did was gather every summer evening under the streetlight, whenever we could, sitting right under the streetlight and tell stories. And I loved that. And my dad was a storyteller. So I saw myself as a writer. And it wasn't until after I was a journalist, right after college, I started in journalism. And it wasn't until my late 20s that I said, I want to know how the world works better than I do. And meaning society, government, politics. I want to know better than I do. I want to know how the world works. So that's what brought me to law school in Chicago, and did not know about immigration law then. That was in the early 1980s, before the current huge wave of immigrants started. So when I graduated in 1985, my first volunteer pro bono work was with Midwest Immigrant Rights Center in Chicago. And I had always been fascinated by immigration without having any connection to it. My great-grandparents had immigrated from Ireland, but I didn't have immigrants in my life. And I was fascinated by the courage, the hope, the ambition, the skill, the sheer energy it takes to be an immigrant, to make your life anew in a new country. So I was very drawn to immigrants without knowing any at all. And right after law school, my world was, you know, quite segregated, as Chicago is a very segregated city, as many of our cities are. So I didn't have immigrants in my life. But that first pro bono case was an asylum seeker from El Salvador. And I happened to stay with Salvadoran asylum for 6 years as a volunteer. So that cemented it. I knew that's what I wanted to do, is practice immigration law, because it was so important. People could not represent themselves in court. There was absolutely no way without an attorney. And that encouraged me to learn Spanish as well, which was it's been a great privilege in my life too, to be able to speak to people directly in their own language, which you know as an immigration attorney too.
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. This is a question for later, but I think it's a good time to ask you now. You say that in those days, this was the 80s and 90s, that you say people couldn't represent themselves in the courtroom. Mm-hmm. What would you say about today's environment then?
Do you know, that's an excellent question, Tamina. I have to say, at least for asylum seekers, because that's the area I know right now, I'm doing some asylum cases through Lawyers for Good Government, which represents people in the Remain in Mexico program who are waiting for their court hearings. Even though we thought it could never get worse than it was in, for instance, 1988, when people were flooding over the border and being given cursory denial after denial after denial in immigration court, it has gotten worse, because people do not even have the court date now. They do not even have the ability to be in this country in order to present their claim, which is a guarantee under our asylum treaties. So we don't have those basic protections, which we took as a given mm-hmm. in the 80s, even though the system was rigged politically, and 3%, for instance, of Salvadorans won asylum cases in a clearly time of genocide in El Salvador and Guatemala. It's worse now. So I have to think that cynically, our government has taken the letter of the law and screwed it down to the last inch, so that the box for asylum seekers is even smaller than mm-hmm. it was.
Well, thank you for working with Lawyers for Good Government and doing the work that you're doing. It's so incredibly important. I want to come back to you. And so you have been practicing immigration for so long. And immigration law, as you just said, has become more and more difficult. November 2016, we lost the election. What happened for you when that election was lost? Mm.
Well, you know, one of my paralegals just reminded me of that. I'll tell you how that happened. So recently I retired. And right before I retired in August 2019, I hadn't realized it, but my paralegal said that I was getting very cynical. And I said, well, gee, it's just reality. She said, don't you remember what you did in January 2017? You called us all together there's five of us in the office, and said, we are not giving up. We are fighting every case twice as hard as we had to before, and we're going to do it. We are not giving up. Our clients need no less than us, and we're going to have to work harder than we ever have, and we're going to do it. We're going to double up on all of our proof. We're doing it. And she said that gave everybody so much hope in our office. And, you know, 2.5 years later, I was dragging. So, it is so much more difficult. The box is so small. But I said, you are right. You are right. I mean, and I do have hope, and I don't need to go around talking in front of everyone about how horrible things are without saying, and we're going to fight.
Mm-hmm. So. And you have been fighting. And this brings me to the actual thing I want to ask you about. You know, us lawyers, we're very, you know, analytical and organized and detail oriented, and we're fighting for something all the time. But the nature of it has changed. And for different people, it has changed in different ways. But what you started out saying is you're a writer. And I actually didn't know the extent of that, your background. But you have taken that writing to a different level when it comes to activism. Are you able to tell us a little bit about what led you to the...
Yes. Okay. So as I said, I've always been interested in immigrant stories. And... because I am a writer, but worked a lot and didn't have much time to focus on it throughout my legal career, I did start writing down what I called stories, but they were basically fragments. I set myself a goal in March of 2011 to write an immigrant story based on my client's experience, changing their names and circumstances, one a week. And post it on a blog, which I did for 1 year.
I wrote, remember that, actually.
Yeah, I wrote that. 36, but they weren't stories, really. They were kind of like story ideas. And I took a playwriting class. Yay! And it was so great. It started lots for me in spring of 2014. And I looked back at that blog, and I took one of the stories, the first one I had ever written, about a guy who gets arrested on suspicion of domestic violence, unjustly. You know, it was a misunderstanding. I mean, it truly was a misunderstanding. And what happened to his family and to him as a result of that arrest? He's an immigrant, an undocumented immigrant. So I decided I'm going to turn it into a play. And I loved doing that so much. And slowly, 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 I got into the theater world, knowing theater artists, taking theater classes, playwriting classes. And I look back in 2011 as well, I had written something called The Detention Lottery. At that point, it was a game. And a church committee on social justice had asked me for it to do a panel presentation, which I did a lot of. I did lots of Know Your Rights presentations in English and Spanish from 2007 all the way through 2019. But I realized that people weren't really getting much out of those PowerPoint presentations. Here's the numbers, here's the statistics, here's what the law is, here's how it's being applied. Those PowerPoints were not producing any action or movement. And so when the church, this particular church, St. Andrew's Episcopal in Seattle, asked me to do one, I said, hey, what if we did a game instead, call it the Detention Lottery? And they said, okay, sure, develop it and we'll put it on. So I did. And it wasn't anything like the Detention Lottery became, but it was an actual, it was, the pieces were there and the committee improvised the roles. So I thought that this group of people would take it on and take it to other churches, but that's so much work. Theater productions are enormously time consuming. And not only that, they're, you know, they're this very high expression of human art, but they're very time consuming. So instead, it languished until 2018, when I asked two other immigration attorneys, Melissa Campos and Karen Tolgo, if they're interested in looking at that with me again, and perhaps coming up with new profiles for the detained people. Because the detention lottery is a courtroom scene. It's 1 hour in a detention, immigration detention courtroom, and at a master calendar, which is the arraignment stage of in an immigration case. So they helped, and we wrote 8 profiles of 8 different people going to be detained. We called together a group of other immigration attorneys, and we said, let's put it on. And St. Mark's Cathedral was our drama ministry, welcomed us to come and do a pilot there in June 2018. And in the first rehearsal, we realized that even with experienced immigration attorneys, we're not going to improv. We can't do that. It just doesn't work. It had to be scripted. So I scripted the play completely. Every word was scripted. And we put together, you know, the whole package that you need. You need the detained profiles. You need, because people are randomly detained as they walk in to the hall where the detention lottery is. And bam, that did it. Having that troop of attorneys having, it was perfect timing for people to say, yes, I want to get involved. We did a sheet up of here's what you can do to get involved that we handed out afterwards. Many thousands of dollars people have contributed to Northwest Immigrant Rights Center and to Aid Northwest and to WISEN, which is a Washington Immigration Solidarity Alliance network. And that continues, or did continue until March, when everything has been on hold with the shutdown. But that, it's taking information that people never had before. It's not easy, although theoretically public, as you know, how difficult it is to walk into an immigration courtroom. It's like, why are you here? There's no room for you. Especially, everybody has to prove why they're there. So, and that's intimidating. Let alone try to get into a detention center. There's many rules to follow.
I want to ask you, so it sounds like the concept was sort of there, but it evolved. And it evolved at the time that it was necessary because you recognized that people needed to have an insight to be more effective. And you gave them that insight that was so necessary. So it sounds like you created the script and then it came together, but this is still a very unique play. It's not just a scripted play. You have immigration lawyers who attend, who are, you know, do this on a daily basis, but you have other people who join. So describe how this play works when it's actually in motion.
Okay. Well, in motion, we have a group of people we call our troop, who receive requests from nonprofit organizations, churches, schools, and we do one a month. We are able to get, you know, our attorney volunteers, who are the actors in the play, have agreed to do one per month, which is, you know, quite a commitment of time with rehearsal, travel, and the production. And we have a volunteer production coordinator who works with the organization, who decides themselves who they want the money that is raised to go to and what materials they want to modify of the ones that we give them for what people can do in the about immigration detention in our country and in general in immigration and the way that our country treats immigrants, especially undocumented immigrants, because everybody in the play it was randomly, so to go to the play itself, when the audience walks in, and we have audiences that generally range between 100 and 200 people, because the play fame has spread, so people have heard about it, especially in the church community in Washington State. And so we've gotten requests from Eastern Washington, which sometimes we can fulfill. We were planning to fulfill them before the shutdown. So when an audience member walks in, one of eight of them are going to be detained, and they're going to be put in a cell block. And the court personnel, which are the actors, including the judge, the defense attorney, the government attorney, the court clerk, and ICE guards, are, we call them, you know, we kind of smash together the roles of ICE and guards in the play. And the guards start circulating to in order to detain eight people. So when those are detained, the play begins with eight people being judged. And the audience watches in fascinated horror. I guess that's the best way to say it. Every time after we do talkbacks, the audience, many people say, I'm horrified that that's how quick it is. It's like an express train. There's no other way that people could see this for themselves. I suppose it's something like seeing in a refugee camp. If you could see what people go through in a refugee camp, which theaters have done amazingly, we've had some really great theater worldwide, internationally, that's set in refugee camps, then maybe our hearts and minds would change. And for this play, hearts and minds are being changed about the need for immigration detention.
What a timely thing that you're doing. And I'm sorry that, you know, COVID-19 has slowed you down in getting this message out, but it's the interactive nature of this with these powerful, insightful description of what happens in the courtroom is just so incredibly needed at the moment, because people just don't know. And so I'm so grateful that you have taken it upon yourself to be an educator and an artist. And, you know, dare I say, you're an activist too. Would you say that?
As an educator, yeah, because I push this storytelling, you know, I'm taking what I can do best, write and tell stories, and using it to talk about people who we normally don't even think as a general society should have come in the right way, right? The right way. They shouldn't have come in or overstayed their visas or, you know, evaded the border patrol. So they're here and their children are here and we're all here together and looking at what happens to them in the immigration courtroom is frightening. It is frightening.
I mean, there were news stories about a judge saying a four-year-old understood everything he said about representing, you know, the toddler representing the toddler's self. And it is laughable, but it's the truth of what's going on. And if an adult cannot represent themselves in the 80s even or 90s, how can they do that themselves today where the laws are being constricted and essentially dismantled, where mm-hmm. people's lives and human rights are being essentially abused? So I'm so grateful you're doing that. And, you know, you're a hero to me. You're a legal hero. You're a legal activist. You know, talking about activism and legal heroism, I wanted to touch upon what you think has changed over the last 3 years. You know, you have come up with a play that is essentially so different and, you know, reaching the masses and telling them something they wouldn't otherwise know about in this detail. But lawyers of all, in all fields have stepped up in different ways. In your opinion, how has the legal field changed or activism grown?
Well, activists, I think that any attorney who takes on a case in a what seems to be a current moment, hopeless situation, and fights it to the max is an activist. For instance, just one example from the 1980s, every single one of those cases in 1988 and 89 of Central Americans who were flooding over the border in those years, 97% of those cases lost, but we still did the very best job we could. We can only represent, attorneys can only represent a small percentage, but we did a good job. Why? Because 10 years later, we had a settlement with the government. It's called the ABC settlement, American Baptist Church's settlement. That settlement brought on behalf of all the summarily denied Central American asylum cases that were just wrote denied, like they're being denied today. Those people became eligible for what's called special rule cancellation of removal, or NACARA. We got that because there was a good job done at the beginning. So cases filed over and over and over. I just talked to an attorney the other day. She is a major activist. She's the director of the Lawyers for Good Government Border Project right now in Brownsville, Texas. She said she had been doing some research and she found more than 900 of the cases that she filed in 1988 and 1989 who had applied for NACARA and, you know, had the chance to become permanent residents of the U.S. because she had filed that. She had filed that asylum application. She was in a program that, you know, had a bunch of people working there and they just filed and filed and filed. Even when it's hopeless. Because that's why we're doing it now, and that's what we're doing right now, doing the very best job we can. Those are activists, attorneys who are activists, who take a case against all the odds and push it to the max and say, we're going to document this case like we're going to win it. And, you know, even though it's like a 3% chance that it might win, we know it's a good case and we're going to
document it. That's true. The chances have dwindled, but the work continues. Well, thank you so much for doing what you do. Before we say goodbye, we have two final questions for you. There are lots of lawyers who are not immigration lawyers, but they are lawyers in their field and they want to do more. What are the three things that lawyers can do to make a difference? And then I want you to follow up with your last words.
Okay, three things lawyers can do who aren't immigration attorneys who are interested in justice for immigrants, right?
Anything. Okay. I mean, what is not under assault from this administration?
That's true. So, environment. Right now I'm working on environmental plays for kids. So I think the primary thing is find what you are most passionate about. It's got to be that, Tamina. It could be immigration for some. It could be the environment for others. It could be Black Lives Matter. Whatever it is, make sure that you're solidly focused in on what you're passionate about. And volunteer your time there. Even though it's hard at the beginning, and if you don't have experience, as you know, if you don't have experience in our immigration field, it's hard to get in right away in pro bono. You have to push it. So do it, push it, and volunteer your time representing individuals, litigating. There's so much to do that, for instance, right now, you don't even need to be that experienced in, because there's lots of like paralegal type work that can be done in the environmental field or in immigration. For instance, those are the fields that I'm interested in. And so that, I think, is getting in there and learning the issues and volunteering your time. Getting in there with what your talents are. Are your talents writing? Do you like brief writing? Oh my gosh, there's a big need for that. I know in the immigration and Lawyers for Good Government right now, it's like, please write briefs. So finding your passion and doing it.
Thank you. Find your passion and just do it. Well, Margaret O'Donnell, thank you so much. Immigration lawyer, playwright, educator, storyteller. good friend, a mentor, and just an overall, you know, legal hero. Thank you so much for being on this show, Tamina Talks Immigration, and we look forward to seeing everything else that you bring to us in the future.
Thank you so much, Tamina. This was such a pleasure to do.
Tamina Talks is brought to you by Watson Immigration Law. Founded in 2009, Watson Immigration Law is one of Seattle's premier immigration firms, specializing in business and investment visas, but offering a wide range of immigration services. If you need assistance with your immigration needs, Watson Immigration Law is ready to help. Just call 206-292-5237 to schedule an appointment. Mention this podcast to receive a 10% discount off your initial consultation fee. Today's episode was produced and edited by Nicole Lockett.